Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Are you using your full potential? Well, today we're going to be talking with Chris Mayer, the founder of the Human Potential Project, about how to unleash your full potential and the potential of your employees. He believes today's management is plagued with outdated modes and habits that limit our potential. And he has good reason to believe that it's like that. I mean, we have a lot of managers who are top down. There's still that outdated belief that they're the ones that have all the answers. And he thinks the companies, and I agree with them, companies need to move towards a much more collaborative place where people can thrive and learn and innovate. And his company teaches companies how to do it in large organizations, not just pockets. You know, I know a lot of people who I don't know about a lot. I know some people who are able to implement and manage and create more pockets of innovation and team environments like this. But his company is actually able to go in organizations and teach them how to change their habits and their modes of operation and become that type of organization. And after we're done talking to him, we're going to talk to Todd Crossland, who's the founder and CEO of Seed Equity Ventures. And his company believes the best entrepreneurs in the world should be funded, no matter who they are or where they live. And that is changing. His behavior is changing the way venture capitalists are investing in entrepreneurs. The current mode of operation is to invest in entrepreneurs that come from certain pockets. Like everybody's investing in Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in certain pockets around the country, but in the world. But the true entrepreneur comes from anywhere. Ideas come from anywhere. And his company is forging new ground at figuring out where these people are and investing in the best and the brightest. And we learn about how he's doing that and what they're doing. But before we start our show this week, we're going to continue with the Evolving with Your Money series. And Tom Shepard, founder and CEO of Shepard Financial, will continue on with the 7 traits. So
hi,
now
Tom.
Let's hear from
interested
Tom
in hearing
Shepard.
More about your natures. We got a couple more left to go over. You have the save and then the invest.
Yeah, well, the saver is one that my daughter, my second daughter, she's a saver. And the thing that I love about her is that she derives a lot of value from having something that other people don't have. And so if she sees people being busy, she wants to have some leisure time. She sees people without any money, she wants to have some in the bank. And so she's a saver. Now, the investor would be somebody who's looking at, what are you going to do with that money? You know, saving for an investor is like, okay, well, you have to do that, but then why do you want to do it? Gets to what motivates an investor.
When this gets investor, back, go ahead. Keep going.
An investor won't save money, but they'll save money in order to invest.
I see. So that's the whole notion of developing a second nature and understanding everybody has a dominant nature, but does everybody have a second nature too that they can develop?
A lot of times what we do with folks is maybe you have a role that forces you into having to be the person that pays all the bills, you know, but if I'm an investor and my role is pay the bills, it might be something that I have to do grudgingly. And so I might end up putting it off and putting it off and ending up in a reactive situation.
Oh, so you become a procrastinator. I know I do that on some things.
Right. So all of a sudden you want to be motivated one way. You have to do something else and it's creating something because you just aren't motivated to do it. And so you end up with several different motivations that are all competing with each other, and you have trouble figuring out which is the right one to actually light the fire under you.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's the interaction between them. Well, we have a couple more that we're going to go over next week, so thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
If you want to learn more about Shepherd Financial, go to my website for contact information at sarahwestall.com. And now we are going to bring on Chris Mayer, and we're going to learn all about the Human Potential Project and how to thrive and get the full potential out of yourself and your workers.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really great. And I'm doing better now that I get to talk to you about your Human Potential Project. What is that?
Well, the Human Potential Project is a company. We're a team of about 40, and we do large-scale organizational transformation work for companies all over the world.
So would you go into Fortune 100 companies and help them transform their culture, or what?
We not only would, we have. We do that with some regularity. That's our sweet spot. It's usually actually more Fortune 500 to 1,000, but our real strong suit is being able to make large-scale change in big organizations.
And so you can actually make change in a large organization, not just pockets
exactly.
within the company? Wow. So you have a process for doing that. What is the main intent that you try to do?
Well, the main intent is really simple. One of the reasons that our economy continues to lag and business growth is kind of stagnant and people aren't very productive is we're still trying to manage modern day companies with management theories and practices that were developed by guys who were born in the 1800s and were designed to be effective in the industrial era. And most people have missed the fact that we're no longer living in the industrial era and those practices don't work anymore.
So they're good for assembly line work or when you're doing specific tasks, but not when you're doing knowledge work.
Well, yeah. And in fact, the distinction we make is it isn't so much knowledge work. Not wanting to argue, but
argue with me.
Yeah, that's an old term. That's more industrial era thinking. What we've entered into is a new era, and we called it the coordination era.
That's good. Yeah. If somebody tells me that, I like that. That's what this show's about, is to move people forward.
Right. So we've moved forward into the coordination era. And the difference is, in the industrial era, the value generators were factory production workers, and they generated value by making things. And that's why we needed those kind of old-style management practices where management was about supervision and we were trying to standardize everything and make it all the same, because you need that when you're making bricks or cars or something. But in the coordination era, the workforce is unlike their grandparents and parents. They're educated, agile, sophisticated, mobile, and they create value not by making things, but by their effective coordination with each other to generate customer satisfaction and enterprise value. So the key sets of skills have nothing to do with supervision and are all about coordination. And unfortunately, most of our management practices and the way we design our organizations work contrary to the needs for coordination.
Well, what do you do in just thinking about the fact that, you know, when you look around at the at different employees, if you ride the bus, for example, in a normal big metropolitan area, there is a big difference between, you know, the people I work with on an everyday basis and the people riding the bus. Do you know what I mean? In their education level and how they operate. And to be honest, a lot of those people have jobs and they do things. How do you get them to coordinate? And I know that we're getting a little bit off track, but I'm just thinking, you know, not everyone, how do you manage that? How do you get collaboration amongst more unsophisticated people?
Well, it's really pretty simple. You just need a set of practices that are designed to enable coordination and collaboration, and have a mindset in which everybody's got something to contribute. We still kind of think that it's the senior leaders who are the only guys who know what's going on, and too often they're kind of out of touch with the interface of where the customers meet the organization. It's the people lower down in the organization that, frankly, have usually a better sense of what's going on out in the world than the guys up in the C-suite.
So basically, we have to have a different perspective on this. And do you think that we're undervaluing people's abilities?
Oh, yeah. We're dramatically undervaluing people's abilities and their capacity for contribution. And if you look at all the statistics, I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. If you're lucky, 50% of your workforce is engaged in what they're doing. And that's, you know, at the high end. So, and the numbers go down from there. So just think about all that wasted productive capacity. And it's not because people don't want to be productive. I've been doing this stuff for 30 years and I have to be careful. I can't say never. Extremely rare is the person who comes to work saying, I don't want to do something great today.
You know? So do you think that people are motivated by just valuing them and expecting more of just being able to see their potential? And
well,
not
that's
looking
part
up?
Of it. That's part of it. Yeah. You have to, the phrase we use, is you have to know how to manage the mood in the organization. The axiom we use with all of our management clients is mood is everything. It's not the only thing, but it's everything. Because if you don't get that right, nothing else you do is going to matter. And when we talk about mood, I don't mean emotions, and I don't mean trying to keep people happy all the time. That's not it.
Yeah, because that
deeper,
doesn't work. That
no, it
turns
doesn't work.
Into a spoiled
brat. That's not
brat.
Our job. No.
Yeah.
Our job is to produce an organizational culture where we value and reinforce moods of ambition, confidence, trust, the sorts of things that enable people and drive them to be productive. But if you check and do any number of surveys will validate this, if you look at what goes on in most organizations, the mood is typically more of resentment, resignation, cynicism, distrust, arrogance, or complacency. And it's all, frankly, due to our insistence on using these outdated management practices.
Well, so how do you go about doing that? I mean, what do you do?
Now we get to the magic. Well, as you mentioned earlier, we've got a particular process that we've developed. It took us almost 20 years to get it to where it was bulletproof. But well, for the last 10 years, we've been deploying this out across organizations. And the challenge for us is everybody's kind of got organizational ADD, right? So, oh, good, you know, give it to me in the top 10 tips list. And we say, no, it doesn't work that way. If you want to really shift the culture in an organization, you've got to engage in an authentic learning process. And where people get stuck is we've got three different, often competing definitions of what learning is, and two of them don't do you any good in a corporate setting. The first is learning as to become aware of. So, you know, I read an article someplace and saw this whole new thing, and wow, isn't that interesting? Now I can go talk about it at a cocktail party, but I can't do anything about it. Then there's learning as in to understand. So, that new idea was so interesting, I went out and bought the book about it, and now I really understand it. And this is where most learning processes stop. We confuse understanding with the authentic learning. Authentic learning is the development of new competence. A new capacity for action. That's the part that matters. And no amount of understanding produces competence.
Yeah, there's you can't just read a book and then be
right.
able to play a sport, for example.
It doesn't work that way. The only way, and this is what people don't like, but it's true, the only way you get competence is from practice. And you gave the right example, sports. You know, it's the perfect place to look. If you want to get better at golf, you can read all the books that Tiger Woods ever wrote, and you're not going to get any better. And where people get in trouble is they say, oh, well, yeah, you're right. I'll just go out to the range and practice. And I explain to them, well, the dilemma with that is all you're going to do is get better at being bad. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the way you get better is you get somebody to coach you who is a different observer of you in the game, and you follow the instructions of the coach. Now, the coach is not necessarily a better player, right? So all the guys who are coaching NFL teams, none of them can play today. But they have the capacity to improve your performance. They can see you in ways you can't see yourself. And if you follow the coaching and do it over time, you will get better. It's no different with learning to be leaders and managers. So this is a long-winded way of saying our programs don't last for a day or two. We don't traffic in happy, clappy, motivational stuff. They last for 7, 9, 12 months. because that's what it takes to install a whole new set of practices in an organization.
I would think it would take time. You know, I got to be honest, I won't even work in environments that aren't like this. I just, that's part of my personality. But I have yet to see anybody be able to implement it in a larger scale. I know people who are amazing and managers who can implement it across their organizations or, you know, but it's usually refined to a smaller group and they just naturally create these environments. But, and I won't even work in an environment that's not like that. And I try to create that around myself, but I am so interested in what you're doing because you are doing it in a larger scale and have mm-hmm. a process for doing it and a process for teaching people how to do it. So what are you seeing are the biggest obstacles to helping, you know, this to happen?
Well, the biggest obstacle, frankly, is small-minded thinking. The two big traps that people get sucked into are, oh, this sounds fantastic. Wow, we could really use this, but we're too busy. Let me get this straight. Okay, everybody's busy, but you're sitting here telling me that what we're doing, we know is not sustainable. We know it won't get us the future that we want. We know it isn't really working, but we're too busy doing it to learn something better, different, right? Now, how rational is that? And then the other one, of course, is you always bump up against the bean counters. We're like, oh, well, this is too expensive. You know, I said, well, too expensive in relationship to what? Doing nothing is going to undo you in some time here. And so what you really want to look at is how does it compare to our other options, right? So all of our programs come with a financial guarantee, right? You get at least 10 times what you spend on us back inside the time frame of the engagement, not at some distant point in the future, or we keep working with you at no charge till we produce that result. So you cannot tell me you can't afford it. Well, but those are the two things we bump up against.
In my experience, people who are constantly engaged in learning and refining, but you're not just learning and investigating things that aren't relevant, right? You're constantly trying to learn about things that make a difference in your organization to make the organization better, your product better, or to be more competitive. Correct? I mean.
Correct.
Because if you're out learning about Atlantis or something and you're not, and it's, you know what I mean? Or something, that's not productive, especially if you're trying to create a new toy or something. Well, maybe it would be if you're trying to create a new toy, but you know what I'm saying. It has to be productive for the business that you're going after. You're talking about heaps more productive. I mean, just enormously more productive if you have a mindset and are constantly thriving and driving and trying to figure things out and trying to be better and encouraging learning than if you're not having that mindset.
Well, yeah, nobody in their right minds would argue with that. And the dilemma is then when it comes time to do that, we get caught up in the we're busy, 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 busy. And because we've got this very short-term focus on everything, well, okay, that's great. You're going to learn all these new competences, but, you know, we need to make money this week. We're too often caught up in this cycle of short-term gratification at the expense of long-term viability.
Well, what do you do how do you deal with that? To a certain extent, you might have a project that's due next week and your customer needs it done. And so how do you schedule in time to create a cultural change?
Well, there's really only one answer. You need a senior leader who's willing to say, I understand, we're all busy. And what I know is if we don't learn some new practices now, we're not going to be so busy in a few years because we're going to be on this downward slide. So rather than wait till we have a gun at our heads, we're going to learn new stuff and we're going to do it now. And so for the next X number of months, this learning process is no different than any other project that you've been given by your boss. We do this. We're going to work it into the schedule. If we need to take some things off the schedule, we'll do that. But this is not something that I expect you to do in your spare time or after work. This is part of working here now, is creating a new future for ourselves. There's nothing more important for us. And absent that, and a consistent holding to it till the process is complete, you'll just get, you know, what we typically settle for, a little flash in the pan efforts, or like you said, there might be some ambitious guy in one part of one division who kind of gets his team reshaped, but it's not scalable across the rest of the organization, and that's why these things fail. So our work is, we're going to take it across the entire organization. We've got a methodology to do it. It's going to be a little disruptive for a few months, but after you get some of these new practices down, one of the first things that happens is people start reporting they have more time, because we showed them how to eliminate a lot of the waste in their day-to-day operating and how to be much more effective in their communication, coordination, and collaboration.
Oh, that makes sense. So you give them some new ways of working so that
absolutely.
That's an important thing. Well, are leaders lacking the ability or the to even understand that this is has a lot of potential?
Well, some are, yes. Now you'll get me going on one of my rants. Unfortunately for us as a country, as we're come out of the Great Depression here, or the most recent Great Depression, too many companies are now run by finance and legal guys who frankly have no real sense of how you grow a company or what it really takes to build a business. They're too oriented around cost-cutting, and they've become dangerously risk-averse, which is one of the reasons we've got more financial capital sitting on the sidelines at any moment in history, is all these guys are sitting around waiting for something that's never going to happen called certainty.
I'm an entrepreneur, so I'd go into that environment, and probably within 24 hours, I would be running to the door. I can't stand that.
Oh, I know. It's brutal, but, and it's killing us. Killing us as a country.
But, you know, that being said, I also ran a company during, you know, 2008, 2009. I know what it's like to manage things very tightly. But you still, you know, we stayed, we did okay just because we grew our customer base during that time frame. And so we all of our customers bought less, but we had a lot more customers.
Yeah.
And took advantage of the downfall. But, you know, I can't stand it. So what do you do? You work on educating the leaders, and if they don't get it, you move on, or what?
Well, pretty much, because if we don't get senior leadership involved and ongoingly supporting the work, it's just not going to happen. So there's, you know, from our point of view, there's no point in wasting our time. Places like this, you know, we're not going to live forever, and we like doing projects where we're going to see a big success. And when people embrace our work, there's never been a time when we haven't failed to generate, you know, what they consider a massive home run. And so, sure, why would we not want to spend time doing that instead of trying to slog through it with some guys where you got to keep dragging them along all the time?
Well, and this is actually a really great change for once the people have lived in an environment like that. You never want to go back because you just really appreciate it. So now what about obstacles of, you know, certain employees that and certain leaders, they have a different mindset because their background, they got baggage and they have, you know, poor, just simply they're raised in bad environments and they've never seen, you know, I mean, you just get people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, let's be real. Everybody's got baggage. You know, it doesn't matter who or where. And there's always people in the organization that you kind of look at and shake your head and go, how did he, she, you know, ever make it this far? And so, as I said earlier, the first thing that we do is there's three variables. If you really want to transform an organization, there's three variables you have to work on. First and foremost is the mood in the organization. Because if you don't get that turned around, then anything else is just going to bounce off. Mostly what we're fighting against in this case is cynicism. So the way that our process works is the first thing we do is we take whoever the group is offsite for a few days and get them out of their environment, get them in a different environment, and we do a lot of experiential stuff with them. So we give them experiences instead of just talking to them. Because the thing about moods is they're not just ideas that people have. They live in their bodies, and you got to get them out of the body. And the only way you can do that is experientially. So as soon as we can get them into a space where they're at least moving towards acceptance or ambition or confidence, then the next thing you do is we start introducing the new practices. And that process is the thing that unfolds over the time because it takes time. We do coaching. We give them real-life work projects to work on. So instead of doing case studies or anything, they're starting to see results in the first couple months in their own real work. That increases this sense of ambition. And after we've been in there, oh, usually 3 or 4 months, one of the things I tell the clients is I say, look, if we're working with more than a few hundred people and we're doing our work well, 3 to 4% of your people will quit. And we don't charge you any extra for that, right?
I can imagine.
Exactly. Well, because now we're introducing new practices for accountability, for managing commitments, for doing what you say you're going to do. These are all essential if you're going to be in a coordination culture.
Well, also,
and
you
the
have
people
egos
who are deeply
and
cynical and don't want to have anything to do with it, they'll leave. And, you know, fine. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Well, what about egos and power needs that leaders may have? Because they have to give, their teams will produce more, but they have to give up that God complex of the manager knows what's best on everything.
Well, you know, there are still some of those characters around, to be sure. But in today's world, we're finding, thankfully, fewer and fewer of them because everything's changing so fast. There's nobody who's got all the answers. And, you know, to be blunt about it, what was the answer 6 months ago probably isn't the answer anymore.
And you're so busy that you're just glad somebody figured it out. Okay, let's go. Thank God you know what we're doing. Let's go.
Thank you, baby Jesus. Let's go. Yeah. So we don't see too much of that, but this is where, as I mentioned, we do these projects and we do coaching. And so where the coaches get involved is helping people use the new practices to get their projects done so they can see real live results. And then also working through some of these issues with people, because typically what we think of as ego issues or, you know, needs for power are frankly just masks for some deep insecurity, right? So let's find out what's underneath all that and deal with that. So whoever it is, let's see what the real fear is here. Is it fear of being seen as incompetent or irrelevant or something? And then let's get that out of the way. And now we can get back to moving efficiently, effectively, back to the coordination, collaboration that would really take. So our job, frankly, is to just remove all the friction in the organization, be it interpersonal, be it structural, whatever it is, so that things move. You know, the biggest killer in any mechanism is friction, whether it's mechanical or human.
Well, you know, when two people start, any two things move in an environment, that creates friction, right?
Yep.
And so you're trying to come up with a method and a way of working so that friction doesn't impede progress. But what about, you know, an engineering environment that, where it is a fairly learning environment? You know, I see this a lot in software companies or technology companies where it is very a learning environment. You got two people who are both very strong in their opinions, and it becomes almost religious, and they each have different ways of doing it, solving a problem. Next thing you know, we got two camps going on. And I know you've seen it. If you've worked that happens all the time in IT organizations.
It does. And so we don't let that happen. The way you prevent that is we introduce a new role into the organization called the resolver. So the resolver's job is to get in between those two camps early, early on before we get this polarization that you're talking about, because you're absolutely right. We do see it a lot. It's very destructive, not to mention very wasteful.
Sure.
And the resolver's job is, okay, let's listen to this side, let's listen to that side, and he, she resolves, okay, we're going to do this, whichever one it is, or it might even be something completely different. And then everybody on the team is clear, at that moment, that's the end of the conversation.
Right? Well, and so everybody wants to be the resolver, although that might be a painful position.
Well, no, there's the resolver is somebody who, of course, knows enough to be able to make an informed decision, but isn't immediately part of the soup that they're in.
Their emotions aren't so high that they can't see past.
They don't have emotional investment in the decision other than what's the best thing for the company.
Exactly.
And then part of being on the team, as I explained to everybody, everybody has this kind of romanticized notion about teams. Oh, we all want to be on a team. And I want to be a team. I said, actually, I don't know that you all do, because real live teams requires a whole lot of rigor. And you got to be clear, teams don't vote. They don't work on consensus, right? You know, when you go into the huddle for the Vikings, the quarterback calls the play. You don't have anybody going, oh, that's not fair. Why does he get to call the play? You know, I'll show him. I'll run my own play. You don't get to do that. So on the team, when the resolver has made the decision, everybody's clear. That's the end of the conversation. It doesn't go one step further outside this room. And if it does, whoever's taking it outside this room has thereby declared he doesn't want to be part of the business anymore.
Well, and you know, if the resolver isn't, if they don't view the resolver as competent,
doesn't matter.
I know it doesn't matter, yeah. But I could see how, like, let's say a very, very skilled engineer having to deal with people around them that aren't as skilled, and then having a resolver that doesn't get it either, and then just be very frustrated all the time. How do you deal with that?
The dilemma is there's nobody, despite what they might think, who's really that smart, so much smarter than everybody else, right? So I know that's, you know, it's like Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory. Huh? Yeah. Those, you know, that's not reality. And so if somebody is so deeply in love with their own ideas that they can't conceive that A might not be best or might not be right, or this might not be the right time, then we got to look at, is this guy really a fit in the organization? Because again,
exactly.
You can't have that character running around there making mischief for very long.
Because it's, the show isn't about them. The show is about serving your clients and getting your product out the door.
Exactly.
And that's what they need to all, everybody needs to understand. This is our focus. Our focus. And that's what happens in a lot of organizations when you get those two polarized camps. The show becomes about putting this particular idea in place versus, well, no, we're serving customers and getting our product out, not putting your idea in place.
Yeah, shocking as it may be, this isn't really about you.
Hello?
I know, get a grip, get it, take a breath. And what we have to understand is the competition is external, not internal. We don't want you guys going at each other all the time here. Yes, we want a little creative tension, and that's how new things get formed, but there is a moment in time where we're playing a bigger game here.
Well, what about people's lack of trust in our leaders? And I think it got back to this whole cynicism thing where you have to get people past the cynic thing, because they've seen so much BS. They've seen people, consultants come in. It just ends up being kind of stupid. They've seen leaders, you know, say one thing, do another thing. How do you get past that whole crisis of trust that is going on in our country?
Well, wouldn't it be great if I had a simple answer for that?
Well, come on.
Come on. Come on.
You're supposed to know everything.
Yeah, that's me. It's me. Okay, look. So let's take that apart a little bit. So do we have a crisis of trust in the country? Absolutely. And that lack of trust engenders something different, which is cynicism. Right? Now, those two are related, but they're not the same thing. The dilemma that you pointed to is real. We have, you know, in any organization, we bring in the, you know, the consultants, which is usually just a cover for we're going to do more cost cutting. And so people are naturally not enthused about all that. We have leaders who really don't really seem to have a clue about what they're doing. And yet, you know, they've got positions of power. So all that, you can make up a big story of, oh, you know, it's all hopeless. Why should I even try? This is all just a bunch of BS, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, what does that really get you? So I sit around, you know, and you become the old cranky guy watching Fox News and barking at the moon. You know, that's not the guy that you want to end up being. So I need to look and go, okay, what's my role in this? So one of the fundamental things that we teach people is a deep, deep understanding and practice of accountability, not blame, not fault, but accountability. How do I have ownership for things being the way they are? Because the one thing and the only thing I can really change is me. So if I'm not happy about this situation, I don't think he, she's doing a good job or whatever it is.
So it's important to have a candid conversation about this.
It's important to have a candid conversation. And importantly, you can't do that if you don't have the skill set for having the candid conversation. So that's another practice that we teach people. Because if I go into my boss's office and I start in, look, here's the problem. You're a jerk. That's not going to go well or far, right? And then I'm going to be the Oh, see, I knew it. Oh, if you tell the truth around here, you get fired.
Well, it might go pretty far, just not as far as, just not in the right direction far.
Find yourself in the parking lot with
exactly.
a box.
Exactly. It'll go far fast.
Yeah, but not quite the direction you had intended. So we teach people how to have the conversation in which you can be authentic with each other and have it be productive at the same time. You know, sitting around name-calling and blame-storming, that never got anybody anywhere. But there's ways in which we can have very frank conversations with people and share our honest assessments in a way that opens possibilities as opposed to closing them. And so, to be clear, it's not some simple little trivial trick or technique. It requires some practice, and we let people do that, and they get to the point where they have to do two things. You have to have the methodology, and then you got to screw up your courage.
Well,
most people
courageous.
Are more content to sit around and complain than they are to go do something about it.
You get a little bit out of your comfort zone. You have to learn how to manage your emotions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We teach people a practice we call centering, which includes learning to manage your emotions and stay present in the moment and how to comport yourself and have a bit of presence in the world. And when you can learn that in addition to the skill set of what we call accountable communication, you can talk to anybody about anything. Now, that doesn't mean you're always going to, you know, quote, get your way, but at least you cannot live in a story called nobody listens to me.
Well, we keep talking about the learning collaborative environment. So now does this require for people to have a certain amount of time to just be able to sit and think and figure things out and not always have things scheduled around their day?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the practices that we teach people is dealing with this invention of our generation called overwhelm, where I have too much to do, not enough time, too many choices, not enough resources. And the killer part to the narrative is, and this is never going to change. So as we tell people, you cannot be a real leader if you're busy all the time. Because being a leader does require time to reflect and think. And we teach and we take people through a practice because, as we show everybody, the big dilemma in today's world is people are over-involved and under-committed. So, yeah, we're involved in all this kind of stuff. And, yes, you're busy all the time. But that doesn't really mean you're doing anything that's important or that really matters.
The less is more concept.
Well, it's not so much, it can be less is more, but let's figure out, for example, the practice, we said, let's make a list of, you know, what are the main things that you're committed to in life? And just to be clear, if there's more than five on the list, then you're not, those are just activities, not commitments. So we get the five. Then I say, now go look at your calendar for the last 2 weeks and let's match what your activities are as opposed to what you say you're committed to. And people will invariably find that they're spending most of their time doing stuff that has nothing to do with their main commitments. So good, then we're going to quit doing some of this stuff. And now we're going to look about how do you manage and design a day? And the big problem most people have is, as you noted, they book themselves in back-to-back meetings. You say, well, that's stupid just to start with. You know, let's just get that. Let's just think about that for a minute. How dumb is that? So you're in place A from 9 to 10, then you're supposed to be in place B from 10 to 11. How exactly were you planning to get from A to B? You know, Scotty was going to beam you, so of course not. You need to walk. You need to go to the bathroom. You need to. So the way we set it up is you set up standards in the organization. No meeting lasts more than 45 minutes, period.
So that you can have your 15 minutes to go to your locker.
They start at the top of the hour, and they're done at 45 after. You then got 15 minutes to take care of your body, go from point A to point B, and you don't book meetings all day. You book at least, if you're a manager, an hour or two every day of unscheduled time.
You have to, yes.
You have
I would
to,
agree
right?
with that.
So,
yeah.
A, because what we pay you to do is deal with the unexpected. So the unexpected isn't going to be scheduled, right? Aha, by its very nature. So if you're constantly knocked off center by, oh, this is happening and this is happening, and it's, yeah, that's what you get paid for.
Or how about just don't go to meetings that aren't that relevant to you? Get the people who are more directly involved and have smaller meetings and less
that's the next process then, is then we have a whole body work on meeting practices and what really needs to happen and how do you have meetings that people actually want to go to and get productive, and then let's get rid of, because half of the ones that are on most people's schedules are completely useless.
Well, they don't contribute anything. So this is a really in-depth thing. I mean, you have to learn how to rework and rethink and how to be just smarter about all this stuff. And it makes sense. It's natural, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's why it takes 9 to 12 months, you know.
Unlearn the bad habits.
Get this from tips and techniques. You know, you're not going to get it just by reading it. You've got to have practices, and we want you to get value. So that's why we do these projects. And they're not projects we make up. They're your real work. So you, the CEO, you tell us, what are the 10 projects you want this team of 100 people to get done? Right? And that becomes then our measure of success. Because what we promise is, you tell me what's the financial value you think this project can generate and how long you think it's going to take. And we will do one of two things. We'll either produce a lot more value than you thought it was going to, or we'll get it done a lot faster than you thought it was going to. And that's how we fulfill our 10X promise. I'll give you an example. We did a big project with Columbia House some years back. And one of the projects they gave us to work on was, we're going to start up a new business unit. I said, okay, great. Have you done this before? Oh, yeah, lots of times. What's your best time from concept to launch? 18 months. Okay. That's our benchmark? Yes. Using our methodology, they went from concept to launch in 7 months. Right. So they got 11 months of early revenue on the project and saved 11 months of burn on the project team. That one project fulfilled our 10X promise. The rest of them, the other nine, by the time we were done, the CFO calculated that we'd produced about a 60X return on their investment.
Oh, it's infinite, I think, because of, I shouldn't say infinite, but infinite in the sense of what kind of value you can bring to people. Well, if, you know, loyalty is low with all the layoffs, trust is low, you know, cynicism is high, all these things. Now, when people go through this and they start to get it and the light bulbs start going off, are they thankful? Because I see this as, you know, when you have kids, you teach them how to have a work ethic and to be responsible, and everything that you do the best job you can. And you kind of approach everything like that. And it seems like you're almost teaching each individual how to rethink what their value is and how to approach how they go about doing work. And so if you end up getting laid off or whatever, it's almost like having a skill set to be able to say, okay, that's okay. I'm going to go into my next project and still feel good about what I'm contributing, because I feel good about how I hold myself and how I work and what my value is.
Well, you hit on something very interesting here. Good question. Most people don't ask this one. Two things here. When we get done with our projects, be they 7, 9, 12 months, we have all the participants write a final assessment about what they learned. And one of the questions we ask them is, what are you most grateful for? And you would be astonished at what people write. I mean, some of it's you know, borderline embarrassing. You know, it's like, you know, you guys have completely changed my life. Kind of along the lines of what you said, you know, I learned all this stuff as a kid and it all kind of faded away. And now, you know, I feel restored, revitalized, et cetera. And as you said, with all these layoffs, so people that we work with are not immune to life. So they get laid off or they opt to leave organizations. And then, sometime in the next year or so, we'll get a note from them. Hey, you know, I'm over here now at this company and I got to tell you, all that stuff you taught us, I'm using it here. I look like a magician to all these people because they haven't learned any of these stuff. It's absolutely amazing. I'm so thankful because you've enabled me to get, you know, two levels of promotion over here at this new company, because these guys are clueless about how you get anything done.
Yeah, and you learn how to be a better you.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
There's a value to it. And now you were saying that the economy's lagging behind, and we have a crisis in this country of just attitudes of people in general, you know, our employees. And to re-energize the base of having more of this kind of a concept of how you go into things. I teach at the University of Minnesota at the Carlson School, and one thing that I was frustrated about this last fall is, you know, probably half the class was just great young people working hard. The other half, and it's not really half and half, but it's a percentage, they just they just don't have that get up and go, get it done, do what it takes to work hard, and the attitude's not there.
No, exactly.
And it's a crisis of attitude.
Well, we've got this segment in our society that are either living in a story of entitlement or, you know, frankly, they're just, like you said, they don't have any ambition. And that's unfortunate for them because they're going to very quickly get left behind. And one of the things that, you know, that we do because we work around the world is, you know, as I said to a group of, you know, business students here recently in the States, you know, I was over giving a talk at a business school in India a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was like an hour, hour and a half. And these kids stayed around and asked questions for another 4 hours.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah,
that's, you know, when it's awesome.
Finally, the guy who runs the school had to come and shoo them away. You know, no, enough. let the poor man go. Around here, you know, you deliver that same talk and, you know, half of them are texting while we're doing this, and they just don't understand what's going on in the rest of the world.
Well, the door can't hit them in the butt fast enough.
Yeah, exactly. The minute that bell rings, you know, it's like a covey of quail taken off out of, you know, a bush or something.
I know. And then you always get a couple of really motivated kids that really want to learn more, and that's so awesome. And then you can tap into a few of them, but for so many of them, they just want to get out that door. But I think that this is great, the Human Potential Project. It's kind of, you know, I coach kids too. I've been coaching sports for a long time, and I teach the kids that working hard and then being good after really working hard. Because if you're gonna succeed, especially in sports, and the better you get, it's hard work.
Yeah.
But you need to learn that working hard in the journey is the fun part, and then when you succeed, it's just amazing.
Right.
And you have to learn to like that process. And it's that same concept. And continually learning and understanding what that's about.
And that's where all of our stuff comes from. We started off, the first iteration of our company back in 1982 was called SportsMind. And all we were interested in was isolating and reproducing in athletes the elements that led to consistent winning performance. And all of our work and the basis of it derives from those early days of working first with athletes, and then that work was so successful it caught the attention of the military, and we spent almost 3 years working exclusively for the Army, helping them redesign the way they train soldiers. And then we did a year-long classified project with the Special Forces where we had a programmatic blank check to push the boundaries of human potential. So we come from that very background.
Well, it makes sense, because that's what it's all about. It's a life lesson. If you can learn how to work hard and to enjoy that process, you can be successful in anything that you want to be successful in. You have to have a passion for it of some sort, because you won't want to put that much. It's hard work. You won't want to put a ton of effort into something you don't have a passion for. But it transform your that thinking can transform your life, and learning how to do that.
Yeah.
Well, that's so awesome. Okay, so the Human Potential Project. How can people learn more about this, and where can they go?
Well, there's a couple ways. One, you can just go to our website, which not shockingly is humanpotentialproject.com. And there you can, you know, read about our history and all this kind of stuff. We've got two ways people can take and do some of our work individually if their company isn't interested or willing to move that way. On our website, I've got a book out called The Power to Transform, and that lays a foundation for an individual who's serious about transforming themselves. And then we've just launched a new thing. You can go to eliteperformanceprogram.com, and what we've done is created our first online program. So this is new for us. It just launched this week, in fact. And this first one is aimed at men. We're going to have the women's program out in about, by the time we get done editing, another couple months. And it's 20 modules. It takes about 2.5 months to complete. It's a very robust body of personal transformation work. And it's the first time we've ever made any of it available kind of to the general public. So we're kind of excited to see how it goes.
Interesting. Okay, well, good. Well, if you can send me that, I'll put that up on the radio page and on my website so people can go and learn and see more about this stuff.
I will be happy to do that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Chris. The Human Potential Project, that's awesome.
Cool.
Okay.
Glad you liked it.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Talk soon.
Again, go to sarahwestall.com to get contact information for the Human Potential Project. And now we are going to finish off the show with Todd Crossland and learn all about how he funds the best entrepreneurs in the world, no matter who they are or where they live.
Hi, Todd. Welcome to the program.
Sarah, thank you for having me.
You have a really awesome message that you share and your firm puts out there, and that is that we believe the best entrepreneurs in the world should be funded no matter who they are or where they live. Why do you stress this so much in your marketing?
Well, I think it comes down from our core values and me as an entrepreneur, and you know, throughout my career, I've started and sold companies and bought businesses, and it's just a belief that, you know, there's certain hotspots of the world that are particularly good for, you know, people to start their companies, but we want to broaden that and let, you know, investors from around the world choose to invest in interesting companies, you know, wherever they are.
It, basically, people with ideas and good people exist everywhere, and it's not just one. They don't just live in one place, right?
Correct. Exactly.
Diamonds don't just come from one mountain in the world.
Exactly.
So how do you think this situation adversely impacts our progress in the world? That so many entrepreneurs are only funded in certain places. How do you think that messes us up?
Well, it stifles innovation to some degree, but I'm quite optimistic in, you know, a reading, you know, you read what the World Bank has come out with, a report on global entrepreneurship and global startups, and really it's a global phenomenon that we're seeing take place, where, you know, entrepreneurs are being encouraged and they're also, you know, getting more funding than they've ever had. And so I think that, you know, if you were in Silicon Valley and you had a great idea, it was easy to get funding. But now, you know, globally, this is becoming, capital is becoming more accessible, and what we're trying to do is to make capital accessible to not just people. We have an office in San Francisco as well, but not just people in, you know, Silicon Valley, but to call it the Silicon Valleys around the world that are developing and turning out great entrepreneurs and great technology.
So you think this situation is really evolving and more people are getting access to funding. What are you doing specifically to really encourage this investment environment shift?
Well, I guess it would go back to a previous company I started in 2001, Interbank FX. We grew the company from, you know, one office in the U.S. to offices in Beijing, Hong Kong, Sydney, Seoul, London, and we onboarded over 250,000 customers and traders from over 140 countries. And so we have vast experience with the international marketplace and dealing with international customers. And after I sold the business at the end of 2001, I looked at what I would like to do next. And I really enjoyed the international nature of building these relationships with investors around the world. And we thought about providing a different asset class. You know, Interbank FX, we were a futures and commodities broker. And the asset class that we're sharing with investors now is the ability to invest in early stage technology companies. So it's a different asset class. It doesn't have quite the liquidity that you would have in the currency or commodities markets, but it also it can be very impactful for, you know, the companies that receive investment as they grow, hire employees. And
do you think it's potentially a better impact? I mean, there's a higher upside from it, right? I mean, if you can invest in some of these companies that really do well, there's a better return on investment. If you're good at finding them.
And I think it's a long-term proposition, and you also need to take a portfolio view to your investing in early stage, you know, technology companies, which is what we focus on.
Right. Like you have to invest
in, you don't want to
like
put all
five.
Your eggs in one basket, but if you have risk capital of a certain percent, and I would say that this should be maybe a small sliver of your investable assets, that you spread that amongst, you know, 15 or 20, you know, technology startups with us, as opposed to putting it all into one or two.
Well, what would be the average then that are successful? Let's say you have 20 of them. How many of those startups do you find end up being profitable and around? I suppose, you know, what is successful is hard to measure, but because different investors expect different things. But how many of those companies are around in 10 years and are sold or are very profitable?
Like I mentioned, it's a long-term proposition, and you know, we're looking at companies that would that have developed, you know, disruptive technology that can grow and either be acquired or grow, you know, to eventually an IPO. So I don't have exact metrics on you know, what the percentage is. But the idea is that if you invest in, you know, 15 or 20 and you're selective and you look at good management and good entrepreneurs that have had success in the past, that your odds will increase quite a bit, especially with a portfolio view, because you could have a couple of really good winners and then you'll have some losers for sure. But I think overall, it's an interesting asset class to look at.
And losers can come from all walks of life. They could come from a successful entrepreneur can lose the second time, right? I mean, because you never know. Sometimes you think an idea is just amazing, but it just doesn't take off for some reason. It's not the right,
correct,
right? Or there's a competitor that is just, they just do a better job at it and the people go in different directions. But now when you look for success, people with successful paths, are you looking for, I mean, I think that's why they stick with Silicon Valley type people, because they're looking for people who have successes in the past. But are you broadening out and looking at different types of people as far as having success in the past?
Well, you know, so we are looking at, and in, I guess success has, you know, different metrics that we look at, but you know, somebody that's, you know, been in a startup before, you know, either as a founder or as a key team member, and, you know, they've gone through the drill, that they know, you know, the effort that it takes. And so we weight those type of individuals quite a bit, but we also look at, you know, education, you know, work experience, et cetera. You know, once we find a company that we really like and we're interested in helping them raise capital, and then we would do extensive background checks on the officers, directors, and large shareholders. So we check for, you know, any, you know, regulatory, criminal backgrounds, et cetera. And so we do a lot of due diligence, you know, on the entire process. Just if it's a good idea, and it's, you know, a good team that we like, but they have to have, you know, good, you know, reputations, and, you know, legally we vet them as well with background checks.
So, having the right team is almost more important than having the right idea, right?
Well, I think it's equally important, because especially in these early companies, if you have the right team, and you run to a roadblock, you can pivot and go a different direction, and But if you've got, you know, talented, you know, team members that you can be persistent and flexible, I think that's why it's so important. So.
Well, because you could have a really great idea. It just needs to be tweaked a little bit to work, right? And they can't, if they're so rigid in their thinking, it just, it could make everything collapse.
Correct.
So you,
yeah,
you...
we invested in one company this year that they launched last spring in 2014 called DemoChimp. And, I think they had about 12 different iterations of their sales approach to, it's a SaaS company, that really helps large sales organizations be, a lot more efficient and helps them to land more, you know, contracts. And DemoChimp, they pivoted several times on their approach and they finally landed on, an area that, has been embraced by large national organizations and large companies. And they're growing nicely. Their revenues are increasing every month. And the founder of DemoChimp, you know, he had great experience. He had a previous exit with the company that he founded. And so those types of, individuals, they really shine just seeing them, you know, work through adversity and then as they have to pivot and change their model to make it work.
They do whatever it takes pretty much, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and you know, with your message of believing in the best entrepreneurs in the world should be funded, do you take a pretty pluralistic approach to it too? Is you don't care what sex they are, what nationality they are, where they live, you're just looking for the best stuff.
Exactly. So we've invested in, you know, primarily they've been U.S. companies, but we've invested in one company out of London that came out of Techstars London, an incubator accelerator out of London, and really good team, you know, great founders with, you know, back to the previous success with other companies they'd founded. And so we were happy to invest in that business and help them. We're getting ready to raise capital for a firm out of Hong Kong. And their primary business is in China. And really good founders and really, really interesting technology and they're providing a solution for large employees in China that is really making an impact not only for the employees but for the large, you know, multinational companies they're dealing with. So it's really interesting. The interesting part of our job, we see so many companies every month and so many founders, and it's exciting to go through all of them. We go through and then we pick out the ones that are, you know, we think it would be particularly interesting for us and for our investors to go ahead and raise money for. So,
well, I just think if the whole world kind of took your approach of just, you know, funding the best and not worrying about anything else, I think a lot of our problems would go away and, you know, we'd have a lot of progress. So I applaud you for that.
Agree.
That focus and really sticking to that, because I think that is, of course, it'll make you more successful in the long run and your investors more successful, but it also helps lead the way to the right behavior and helping everybody, you know, breaking down walls and just, you know, that kumbaya thing. But yet it's better business in the long run.
Well, it is, and if you look at so with our current company, Seed Equity Ventures, we have over 100 countries represented on our platform of investors and entrepreneurs from, I think it's 104 countries right now. So as diverse as you can imagine, the world is interested in finding and investing in good, you know, good entrepreneurs, no matter where they live. So,
and wherever they're from, they don't care what they are, as long as it's a good idea and they're good people. So,
yep.
So what do you see as the most exciting developments out there? I mean, you're seeing everything. I mean, everything comes across, I don't know about everything, but you're seeing so much that comes across your desk. What do you see as the most exciting? I mean, I see a lot just in my, you know, my show. I'm talking to a lot of entrepreneurs every day, but I kind of go through and try to pick the best people to bring on board here to have on my show, but you're seeing a ton of things. And so what do you see as the most exciting developments out there?
Well, it's probably an overused phrase, but you know, the democratization of finance. And, you know, it started with, you know, crowdfunding with say the Indiegogo or Kickstarter, where you can, you know, earn a reward for, you know, supporting, or get a product, an early product. And now that's shifting to, you know, especially globally, in Europe, it's really advanced. Would be, you know, the equity crowdfunding movement throughout Europe and the rest of the world, where they're letting individual investors invest in, you know, companies that they are interested in following and passionate about, and receive equity in the company. And what we've seen in the U.S. since the Jobs Act was passed in 2012 is it's been a kind of a trickling down from the SEC and FINRA of regulations that have opened the doors for, you know, entrepreneurs to have easier access to capital.
Well, I think it's, you know, I had somebody on earlier, probably about 6 months ago, that we were talking about how that's probably the biggest change in the financial markets since, you know, maybe even this century, since the 1930s. When they, you know, changed how, yeah, it's a big, big deal.
Yeah, just general solicitation where companies, where we can post a company on our, you know, broker dealer platform, seedequity.com, and where, you know, investors from around the world can view the offering, go into the data room and look at, you know, financials and information on these businesses, that wasn't available, you know, 2 years ago. And, you know, they passed, you know, Reg A Plus, which is a change in the security rules on, the size of offerings that can be done under, it's called Regulation A. And it used to be $5 million max, and they raised that to $50 million. And they also allow non-accredited investors to invest in Reg A offerings now. So
when did that pass? Because that's a big deal, the non-accredited investors to be able to invest.
So that's on a specific type of offering, which is Reg A Plus or Reg A, and that went live in June. And so that's
a big deal.
The one that you might be referring to though, Sarah, would be the it would be Title III of the Jobs Act, and that would really open the door for non-accredited investors to invest in all of the private placements.
When do you think that
take place in the U.S.?
Do you think that will pass, and when do you think it will if it does?
So there's been lots of discussion on it. I guess the one thing that I'm hopeful and encouraged by is the rules and regulations that came out with Reg A Plus. They were pretty even. I think it was a pretty well thought out response from the SEC to those that want to participate with Reg A Plus offerings, and it didn't make the hurdles too onerous for either investors or companies who want to participate. And if Title III of the Jobs Act contains that same thoughtful response that that Title IV included, which was the Reg A Plus, then I think it bodes well for the final rules that will come out. Well, last year the SEC came out and they said, you know, they were hoping to have final rules by October of this year. So we're hopeful that it will be this year, but we'll have to see. But based on the most recent pronouncements out of the SEC, I'm hopeful that it will be, you know, reasonable and thoughtful, that will be doable for both investors and for you know, startups that are raising capital with non-accredited investors.
Well, there's this potential for, I mean, there's an explosion of new ideas and inventions going on, but they're not really being funded at this point. So this could be an explosion of progress, you know, I mean, with the means for people to do it. Now, that's if I'm taking an ultra positive look at it, it could be incredibly positive. Obviously, you're saying from the other perspective, you know, there could be problems if it's not thought out well. And you know what? Let's be frank. There will be problems. Hopefully they will address them quickly and, you know, rein it in quickly, so that this explosion of progress can go forward, because it's pretty exciting time.
It really is.
So now, how can people get hold of you? Let's say they have a really good idea or they're an investor. How can they get hold of your firm and see what you have and see if you're a good fit for them?
Sure. So Seed Equity Ventures, we're a registered broker dealer with the SEC and FINRA. And then our investment portal website is seedequity.com, and then that's probably the best way to get a hold of the company. Then you can learn more about how it works to become an investor and how it works to, if you're looking to raise capital for your startup as well. So
okay,
that's
probably
the best place to go.
Well, I really appreciate this. Thank you so much, and thank you for having such a great outlook on how you approach this stuff.
Well, Sarah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
So remember, if you want to contact anybody on our show, go to my webpage at sarahwestall.com and get their contact information. And also, my webpage is being redone. It should be up and going in another week and a half here, probably by the end of July, I am hoping, which we think it will. And I will start having exclusive content that you can get on my webpage only. Some, you know, longer interviews with the guests and special interviews and some videos and different things that I'll have and articles that I've written. And so be sure to go to my website at sarahwestall.com and find all that great stuff. And so for now, have a wonderful day.